Well, if you stayed up late enough, or if you had the forethought to put a tape in the VCR or program TiVo to pick this thing up, this is well worth watching, this PBS special called The Question of God. We mentioned it in a previous broadcast of Issues, etc. It is essentially a treatment of two lives, one of Sigmund Freud, the other of C.S. Lewis, two men whose lives not only overlap in history, but overlap in some very interesting ways with some very different outcomes. We're going to be talking about that special, the PBS special, The Question of God, hearing a bit of sound from it, reacting to some of the things that Freud put forth when the two worldviews of Freud and C.S. Lewis are contrasted in this special. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery joins us here for the first hour of Issues, etc., as we look at these two major worldviews of the 20th and the 21st centuries. Actually, it goes back into the 19th century, too, with both of these men. Perhaps two of the most influential thinkers in the 20th century, without a doubt, Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. And then we'll add to that list here by the end of this hour, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. I told my producer earlier today, probably in 100 years, they'll be studying Montgomery the way today we study Lewis. Stephen Wagner will be our guest in the second hour of the program for about 25 minutes. We're going to talk about the U.S. News and World Report cover story, Miracle Babies, all about reproductive technology, or what they're calling assisted reproductive therapies. He's a bioethics speaker for Stand to Reason. Then, in the next half hour, we've got open lines for questions and comments. We'll be hearing a bit from Jimmy Swaggart, who, if you were watching the news, this made national news, by the way, had a few things to say about gay marriage. And I'll leave it at that, and we'll let Jimmy do the talking at 4:30, and I'll get your reaction to it as well during that half hour of open lines. In the third hour of the program, Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us for part 8 of our 11-part daily series on Islam. Today, Islam and science. I believed for a long time that Islam was, and the Islamic world was, in fact, the originator of much of science, of mathematics, astronomy. Where did the Muslim world get these things, and what occasioned the reintroduction of many of these disciplines and arts through Islam? We'll talk about that with Dr. Alvin Schmidt there. And then in the last half hour of the program, the organ. You see it in church, you hear it in church, some of you don't. What is the role of the organ and Christian worship? David Schack, a composer and an organist, will join us along with Mark Bender, who's minister of music at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in De Pere, Missouri, for the last half hour of Issues, etc. Our call-in numbers, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is a regular guest. He's professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He is distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he is author and editor of more than 50 books, including a book called Tractatus Dr. Montgomery, you're going to refresh my memories. Tractatus?
Logico-theologicus.
Yes.
It simply means a logical-theological tractate. It's a takeoff from a work by Wittgenstein that has had great influence on contemporary philosophy.
Now, this PBS series, The Question of God, contrasts the lives and the worldviews of two of the most influential 20th century thinkers, Sigmund Freud and C.S. Lewis. You actually had some correspondence with C.S. Lewis earlier in life. Tell us about it.
Years ago, I debated the head of the philosophy department at the University of British Columbia in Canada. This gentleman claimed that there was so little historical evidence for Jesus that one really couldn't intelligently maintain Christian belief. The man's name was Stroll, and he later went to, I believe, a branch of the University of California. In any case, I read about this in the paper. I was teaching at a Canadian university in the East at that time, and I made a few comments to the press, such as this was a village idiot's approach to Christianity, and as a result of the furor that arose, I was shipped out to the University of British Columbia, and I debated Stroll. Following this debate, which was very successful, and the content of this is included essentially in my book, Where is History Going? and also History and Christianity. After this, the people who sponsored my debate wanted to get C.S. Lewis to come over and debate or speak at the university. And so I contacted him, sent him a copy of what I had presented, and he graciously wrote back and said that this was simply excellent in every respect, and that letter is included in my book, History and Christianity, and Where is History Going? But he said that he had suffered a heart attack and was not going to be traveling in the future. He said, I almost got through the gate last summer. And shortly thereafter, not too many years thereafter, he, of course, passed away, died on the very same day that Kennedy was assassinated. So there was that contact. And also, I did an article concerning his Narnian Chronicles when I was working on the doctorate at the University of Chicago. And I sent that to him. And he sent a very appreciative letter concerning that. And that's included in my book, Myth, Allegory, and Gospel. I never had direct face-to-face contact with Lewis, but those two contacts by letter were very, very productive. And Lewis had a great deal to do with my own conversion when I was an undergraduate at Cornell University.
Speaking of Cornell, if I'm not mistaken, there's another connection here with this PBS special, The Question of God. The author of the book upon which it is based and the executive producer of The Question of God, Armand Nicolai, was apparently a fellow college student with you. Was it at Cornell?
Yes, it was at Cornell. When I was an undergraduate at Cornell, Nicolai came to Cornell to take a master's degree in science. He had taken his undergraduate work, I believe, at Syracuse University and had not been able to get into medical school, medical school being as difficult to get into in those days as it is today. And so he came to Cornell to take a master's in order to improve his chances to get to medical school. And that's where I came to know him. He was a solid-believing Christian. We were both active in the InterVarsity Christian Fellowship chapter at Cornell, and in subsequent years, I maintained contact with him. For example, when I was the dean of the Christian Law School in California, the Simon Greenleaf School of Law, now part of the Trinity International University, I invited Nicolai to come and deliver a guest lecture there, which he graciously did. So, yes, I have a personal connection with Nicolai. We are fellow Cornelians.
And let's begin our conversation about these two men, these two lives, and these two worldviews by at least providing a sketch of each one of these men's lives, beginning with Sigmund Freud. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he is one of the great names in modern atheism. Freud became convinced that the Jewish religion in which he grew up was a myth. And he determined that the God idea was a projection of human needs. He did a book entitled The Future of an Illusion, and the illusion was the Old Testament belief in God, which he regarded as a projection of the father image, essentially. And he maintained that atheistic secularism throughout his whole career. What he tried to do was to get at the nature of human motivation, and he became convinced that that our motivations are primarily derived from unconscious attitudes that we have picked up, and these attitudes come either from heredity or from environment, obviously. But the two major ideas are the libido, that is to say, the life urge, that often in popular parlance regarded simply as sex, but it's much more profound than that. It's the urge to live, to propagate, and also to expand one's experience. And then toward the end of his life, he added the mortido, or the death wish, to this. And but all of this is materialistic in nature. All of this bubbles up from the material nature of the human being. It does not have a spiritual dimension on any level whatsoever. In his work, Moses and Monotheism, he directly goes against the idea that the Old Testament presents a revelation from God. This is a human projection. It is not something that is given by a transcendent God at all.
We're going to have Dr. Montgomery in just a little bit respond to some of the ideas of Freud one by one. Some of he's already enumerated there. How would you calculate Freud's influence in both modern and postmodern thinking?
It's staggering. He is the founder of modern psychoanalysis. Everyone else in modern psychoanalysis takes off from him in one way or another. His student, Carl Gustav Jung, rejected the narrow materialism of Freud, but continued with the notion that our motivations are essentially unconscious. And that notion of the unconscious is fundamental to all contemporary psychoanalysis. So are concepts such as transference, that it's possible to transfer to the psychiatrist the difficulties that one faces, and it's possible to work these difficulties through by that kind of a relationship, etc. And even the psychologist today, the psychiatrist, is well acquainted with Freud's ideas, and those ideas have had a staggering impact.
A brief biography of C.S. Lewis.
Well, Lewis was of Northern Irish extraction, and though he grew up in what we would call an Anglican or Episcopal setting, he early rejected Christianity, and then later he came to believe in it. He said he was dragged kicking and screaming into the kingdom by the weight of the evidence. And this evidence was twofold. First of all, it was objective historical evidence. He saw the powerful case for Jesus Christ as presented in the New Testament, and the solid historicity on a historical basis of that evidence. And then secondly, he saw that that human beings have certain fundamental needs, and these needs are exactly satisfied in what Christ did on the cross for us. In other words, he saw the fulfillment of the human quest as coming about in what Jesus Christ did. So the objective historical evidence and the internal subjective evidence conjoined, and this brought him to Christian faith. His career was spent as an academic. He was ultimately a professor of medieval and Renaissance English literature at Cambridge, though most of his teaching career was spent at Oxford. And his emphasis was on the literary side of things from a professional standpoint, but his most popular writings, of course, were in the field of Christian apologetics. When I was an undergraduate at Cornell, I had a non-Christian Jewish professor by the name of David Deitches, who said that Lewis had more impact on furthering the Christian faith in England than anybody else in his time, including Billy Graham.
And in addition to that, very briefly, before we get to some of the excerpts from this PBS special, The Question of God, for your response, how would you calculate Lewis's influence today in the 21st century?
Well, it seems to me that the impact of his writings is probably greater even today than that of any other modern Christian, as far as convincing or being able to persuade non-Christians to take the Christian faith seriously. This is for a couple of reasons. For one thing, there is the aura connected with Oxford and Cambridge. Americans, you know, when they die, they want to go to Oxford. So that's a big factor. But more than this, Lewis was not a theologian and did not write using theological terminology. He wrote using the language of the modern educated person, and that means that these writings are accessible. Most of the writings done by professional clergy and by theologians are virtually incomprehensible to anybody else because of the technical vocabulary or because of in-group language. These people are really writing for those who are already Christian. But Lewis, thank goodness, didn't write that way.
Let's listen to an excerpt from this PBS special, The Question of God. This will be an actor portraying Sigmund Freud, but quoting from Sigmund Freud's writings on the nature, or the, what he considers to be the true nature of revelation.
Science asserts that there are no sources of knowledge of the universe other than carefully scrutinized observations. In other words, what we call research. And alongside it, no knowledge derived from revelation, intuition, or inspiration.
Dr. Montgomery, your reaction to this idea put forth that knowledge is impossible apart from what he called research.
The irony, of course, is that if one takes that view seriously, that you've got to look at the facts and do serious research as to what has actually occurred, then that ought to lead you to an investigation of the case for Jesus Christ, which is a historical case. This evidence is objective. This evidence exists in history alongside of any other historical events. The problem with Freud is that he engages in what is technically known as reductionism. He reduces everything to his own concept of what facts are permissible, and anything that falls outside of that range, he simply refuses to look at it. This turns out to be just the opposite of good science. It turns out to be utter dogmatism.
What disturbed me in listening to some of the roundtable that took place in this PBS special is that they had the Freudian position there, and that is that we can only discover truth through empirical observation, and that if it doesn't fit into our idea of what must be natural, we dismiss it out of hand, even if it is part of empirical observation. The response that they gave in this roundtable to it was not a Christian response per se, but a more postmodern response. It was, well, you know, don't discount individual experience, and don't discount my truth as opposed to what's true for everyone. Is that the proper Christian response?
Oh, for goodness sake. No, the proper response to this is that we can't prejudice the nature of the universe by our own reduced concept of what it consists of. You've got to get off of your rear end, get out there, and check the facts. And if the facts are uncomfortable, well, so much the worse for you, not so much the worse for the facts. And this means that it is essential to face the claims of Jesus Christ. These claims appear in history like any other historical facts, and the issue is simply whether there's enough ground to go along with them. And the major ground for going along with them, of course, is the resurrection, the fact that he objectively rose again from the dead and fulfilled the prophecies of the Old Testament. And if that's the case, then we are dealing here with something far more significant than just an ordinary human life. As he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me.
All right, then, let's hear from Freud. These are some of his thoughts. You mentioned this before, but we'll get it from his own words. These are some of his thoughts on his mother.
My libido toward my mother was awakened on the occasion of a journey during which we must have spent the night together, and there must have been the opportunity of seeing her nude. In my own case, I discovered that I was in love with my mother, and now consider it a universal event in early childhood.
And then, Dr. Montgomery, these are some of his reflections upon his father.
One time he related to me a story that left a profound impression on my life, though not the one that he had hoped. He said he wanted to tell me how much better things for the Jews were now than before. Then he told me, when I was a young man, I went for a walk in the streets of your birthplace. I had a new fur cap on my head. A Christian came up to me and knocked off my cap into the mud and shouted, Jew, get off the pavement. I asked my father what he had done. He said, I went into the roadway and picked up my cap. This struck me as unheroic conduct on the part of the big, strong man who was holding the little boy by the hand.
And then, Dr. Montgomery, this is how Freud applies these thoughts about his own parents to religion.
The child's attitude to the father is colored by a particular ambivalence. The father himself constitutes a danger for the child, perhaps because of its earlier relation to its mother. Therefore, it fears him no less than it longs for him and admires him. The indications of this ambivalence in the attitude toward the father are deeply imprinted in every religion. God was the exalted father, and the longing for the father is the root of the need for religion.
Dr. Montgomery, your reaction to these reflections on his parents and how he applies it to what he calls this universal phenomenon of religion.
Well, there's little doubt about the fact that authority figures are both loved and hated at the same time. And Freud was quite correct in observing that the child has a tendency both to love and to hate his father simultaneously for various reasons, just as one does one's teachers or what political figures, one's boss or whatever. But it's one thing to draw out that truth. It's another thing to argue that that's how we got our theology. That's how we got our ideas of God. The fact of the matter is that it might be an entirely different structure of explanation that would be appropriate. For example, let us say, just hypothetically, that there is a God who loves us, and he gave us everything. And among the things that he gave us was free choice. And we misused this. We destroyed ourselves by our selfishness. And then the history of the human race might well consist of our longing for a relationship with that God again, and yet at the same time a resentment at the fact that there is punishment and judgment that passes on us for what we ourselves have done. If this were the case, then that would very nicely explain why people's attitude toward God in all the religions of the world consists of what? Both attraction and repulsion. In the case of Christianity, of course, it's God himself who bridges this gap. He comes to earth for us and even allows himself to be killed at our hands. And as a result of this, he saves us. He makes it possible for us to enter again into a relationship with him. I mean, this is a far more profound understanding of the relationship between man and God than Freud ever conceived of. Freud's psychology was often very profound, but his theology was utterly primitive. And the irony of this is, of course, that in modern times, if in the modern age, if somebody accomplishes great things in a secular field, then people will naively think that anything that the individual says in the area of theology ought to be accepted. And, of course, that's utter nonsense. On another program, I think I mentioned that Eleanor Roosevelt, wife of Franklin D. Roosevelt, used to write religion columns for Women's Home Companion magazine. She didn't know anything about theology.
The Lutheran faith.
We'll be right back.
First century. You're listening to Issues, Etc. I guess you've probably seen the healing services on television, but do these faith healers have a biblical understanding of faith and healing? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is titled Order Restored, A Biblical Interpretation of Health, Medicine, and Healing. It's published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. Order Restored costs $20.99, plus shipping and handling, 1-800-325-3040. Or you can find out more about Order Restored on our website, issuesetc.org. Just click the What's New section. How important are faith, attitude, and community in healing and wellness? Find out with Order Restored, our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September. 1-800-325-3040. Or look it up on issuesetc.org.
Lead me, Lord, oh, follow, This Global Minute shares that boys and girls benefit when they understand they can have an active role in God's plans. Music, local outreach ideas, and stories about answered prayers are key ways that Worldwide Kids Club inspire children to tell others about Christ. The website worldwidekidsclub.com also offers ideas to direct boys and girls in how to serve in their own local neighborhoods. It could be feeding the hungry or service projects done in Christ's name. There are a variety of helpful articles for children and their parents. Pray for more boys and girls, whether they are in your immediate family, your church family, or the churches abroad, to get a deep conviction of God's calling on their lives. Pray they will commit to the Lord to serve in spiritually needy areas of the globe for His glory. See helpful tips on the website www.worldwidekidsclub.com. That's worldwidekidsclub.com.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute, and happy birthday to you, Caesar Augustus.
Who?
The first century B.C. saw civil war throughout the Mediterranean world. Caesar Augustus established himself as emperor and ruled from 27 B.C. until his death in 14 A.D. The first century historian Tacitus wrote, "When the world was wearied by civil strife, he subjected it to empire under the title prince." His birthday, September 23rd, was celebrated throughout the Mediterranean world with parades, sacrifices for his welfare, and a general carnival atmosphere. Now, Augustus, of course, was no Christian, dying when Jesus was a teenager. He was kind toward the Jews throughout his empire, part of his policy of kindness toward all subjugated peoples. Because he put in place the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, a sect of the Jews, the Christians, was able to practice their beliefs and grow rapidly in numbers. God works that way, using world leaders who do not acknowledge Him to serve the people who do. Hence, Paul wrote in 1 Timothy, "I urge that requests, prayers, intercession, and thanksgiving be made for everyone, for kings and all those in authority, that we may live peaceful and quiet lives in all godliness and holiness." So, happy birthday, Augustus, wherever you are, and we're reminded to pray for our leaders.
For better or worse, young children often imitate their parents. On the next Focus on the Family, Dr. Donald Joy talks about how your example shapes your child's character in everyday life. Learn how discipline, responsibility, and moral understanding work in the different styles of child development. On the next Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
To my own dreams. I am led to my own dreams.
Trying to take away my worries of today and leave tomorrow behind.
As I fall asleep, involuntary ideas emerge.
Ooh, dreamweaver, I believe we can reach the morning light.
I am led to my own dreams.
Fly me high through the...
We're talking about the PBS special, The Question of God, that features the worldview of both C.S. Lewis and Sigmund Freud. And we're discussing in particular the Freudian worldview and getting the reactions of Dr. John Warwick Montgomery here on Issues, Etc. in this hour. Dr. Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including Tractatus Logico Theologicus. That's one of his latest books as well. Now, you can purchase this book by calling 780-461-3076. That's the phone number for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, 780-461-3076, or visit them on the web at CILTPP.com, CILTPP.com. The book is called Tractatus Logico Theologicus. Dr. Montgomery, one of the things that that Sigmund Freud said when he rejected revelation in favor of what he called science, one of the places where he started to look for truth was, as he said in that little soundbite we heard, he went to his own dreams. Tell us about what Freud was looking for and what he found in his dreams.
He was looking, of course, for personal fulfillment. And his manner of interpreting these dreams was along the same reductionistic lines that we've talked about. What he did was to try to relate these dreams to early childhood experiences. It's interesting to compare how Carl Gustav Jung dealt with the dream life. Jung felt that Freud was far too narrow in his handling of this sort of thing, that the materialistic reduction of dream life and everything else actually impoverished the human being. And so when Jung interpreted dreams, Jung came to the conclusion that they represented what he called the archetypes of the collective unconscious. That is, these were various fundamental motifs which were built into all human beings. And these motifs, interestingly enough, included and concentrated on a longing to restore the broken fragments of the human personality, a conjunction of opposites. Jung said that the cross was the finest symbol of this kind of reconciliation possible. So Jung attempted to rely on spiritual ideas. He included occult ideas with these, but this simply shows that you don't have to interpret dream life along the narrow materialistic lines that Freud did. Dreams are far more complex, just as the universe is far more complex than Freud realized.
What about this this contrast where Freud, instead of looking outside himself, which he said his empirical method would have led him to do, he instead looks inward? And in terms of contrasting that with Christian revelation, where Christian revelation is found outside of me, what's wrong with looking inward as Freud did to his own dreams, his own childhood, his own interpretations?
Well, the difficulty, of course, is that we are a fallen race. If you look inside, there is the image of God there, of course. If there weren't, you wouldn't be a human being at all. You'd be a kumquat or whatever. The image of God is there, but as a result of our selfishness, as a result of the fall, there are all sorts of perverse ideas and incorrect understandings that one comes across. If one only looks inside, result may very well be that one will come up with a view of oneself and a view of the universe which isn't accurate at all. It's the product of human selfishness. We will, in other words, get the view of the universe that we would personally like rather than the view that is actually there. And it's for this reason that Luther said the entire gospel is extra nos. The entire gospel is outside of us. We need to go outside of ourselves and see what God has done for us objectively. And that's why it is so desperately important to check out the case for Jesus Christ, to see what God has done for us in his living word in Jesus Christ and what he's done in the Holy Scriptures. There we can get a picture which isn't contaminated by the sin which we will find inevitably inside of ourselves if we limit our perspective to that.
Folks, if you have a question or a comment on the PBS special, The Question of God, Sigmund Freud or C.S. Lewis, give us a call now at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. We have an in-studio email address as well, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery is our guest. We're getting some of his reactions to the Freudian worldview that was being presented in a very accurate way, I think, in this PBS special, The Question of God, and contrasted with the worldview of C.S. Lewis. This notion that that Freud was trying to find some objective truth, I think I've heard you say before, of Freud and of others, that you can often discover more about someone like Freud by examining his way of thinking than you can about objective truth.
oh, this is quite right. And the quotations that you've already presented from the PBS special shows that that's the case. His comments about his relationship to his mother and to his father. Another interesting illustration of this from another atheist is Bertrand Russell's autobiography. In the first volume of it, Russell talks about the very bizarre aspects of his childhood and the strange relationship that he had with relatives and with nurses and so forth, and he doesn't seem to realize that what this is doing is helping us to understand how he ended up in his atheism. And if one looks at the biographies of atheists, one finds this sort of thing. The irony of it is that the psychologist usually refuses to look at his own unbelief seriously. What he does is to try to analyze the peculiarities that turn people into Christians. The effort is made to explain away Christian belief and conversion and so forth. William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, for example, attempted to do this kind of thing. But I go along with R.C. Sproul, who did a book a number of years ago entitled The Psychology of Atheism. It's a popular work. Sproul is not trained in psychology, but it certainly emphasizes the fact that, if Scripture is correct, that the fool has said in his heart there is no God, then you don't have to explain belief. What you have to do is to explain unbelief. And the weapons of modern psychology and psychoanalysis ought to be turned onto the atheist rather than simply allowed to be used against religious believers.
You know, this kind of explains why the atheist enterprise, whether you find it in a Freudian variety or any other variety, seems to be bent upon, what would we call it, a polemical task.
Oh, I think this is true. And it's interesting also to look at the concept of the unconscious. You know, the non-Christian psychologist will say any time that one brings up some objective fact in relation to Christianity, but you see, the real issue is unconscious. You don't really understand the motives for your going along with this. The motives are actually unconscious and within you, okay? Now, if you think about this logically, that no one's objective understandings are worth anything, that instead it's necessary to go through analysis in order to discover the real motives, then, of course, this is an infinite series, isn't it? How did Freud know that the viewpoint that he came up with was objectively true? I mean, who analyzed Freud to find out what the true motives were for his viewpoint? This is an infinite regress. You've got to start out with the assumption that there is an objective reality out there and you can get at it. It's true that we corrupt this often through our own unconscious motivations, but unless there is an objective reality out there, then it would be impossible to discover anything about the unconscious anyway.
Here again is another excerpt from the PBS special, The Question of God, again, a quotation from Sigmund Freud, this time on his God.
Religion is the universal obsessional neurosis of humanity. Like the obsessional neurosis of children, it arose out of the Oedipus complex, out of the relation to the father. Our God, reason, will fulfill whichever of our wishes nature outside us allows.
Dr. Montgomery, let's deal with the two parts of that statement there. First of all, his characterization of religion as the universal obsessive neurosis.
Well, it's an interesting theory. I guess my question would be, did he rise from the dead, Freud, and thereby demonstrate his deity and therefore his ability to make a universal generalization of this kind? If he didn't, I'm sorry, I'll go along with Jesus, who did rise from the dead and who says that instead of religion being a universal neurosis, it happens to be the most fundamental category in our experience, and we need to come to terms with God as God has revealed himself. Freud is offering there an apodictic assertion concerning the nature of the universe. He's offering an absolute interpretation of religion. Now, last we heard, water doesn't rise above its own level. Freud was only a human being. What makes us think that some kind of an absolute statement coming from his lips therefore turns out to be true? Only absolute statements are worth anything if they come from an absolute source. And that's why we go with Jesus Christ instead of with Freud.
The other part of his comment there where he says, our God reason will permit us to fulfill whatever wishes nature outside ourselves will permit. What is he saying there?
I'm not quite sure. Would you want to repeat that?
Well, first of all, what should we make of Freud characterizing reason as our God? I'm assuming he's speaking for himself.
Well, if by this he means that our reason is the most godlike characteristic that we have, of course we have to use our reasoning in order to arrive at conclusions. But the trouble with Freud is that he didn't use his reason appropriately. If you use reason appropriately, then you're going to check out the facts that are relevant to your claims. And if he were correct that religion is nothing but a neurosis, then it couldn't possibly be the case that God revealed himself in the scriptures and in Jesus Christ. But the evidence lies there.
Our call in numbers, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Our email address here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. What prevents me from turning the tables on Sigmund Freud and saying your belief system, Sigmund, qualifies as a religion as well and therefore falls under the category of a universal obsessive neurosis?
Oh, it's a perfectly valid criticism. No doubt about that, because a religion, in Freud's terms, is an ultimate commitment of some sort, and certainly he made that ultimate commitment along the lines of the quotations that you've used. So the thing turns around and bites him in the rear end. That kind of a viewpoint is equally applicable to him as it would be to anybody else. There's little doubt about the fact that when he describes religion as a neurosis, this can be a correct description of a given person's religion. I mean, there are a lot of religious people, including people in Christian churches, who look at God as a means of giving them things that they couldn't get otherwise, you know, sort of the cosmic bellboy. There's little doubt about the fact that descriptively there are a lot of people who have that kind of religious life. But that is not the same thing as claiming that no religion is true and that every religion has to operate that way. I mean, obviously that isn't the case. If you look at the history of the Christian church, you look at people like Augustine and Luther and Dwight Moody, Billy Graham, whatever, you look at these people and they are not in that category at all.
What concerns me is that the intellectual descendants of Freud have gone from, and this is probably more popular nowadays, that Islamofascism has come on the scene for everyone to see, and it's seen as being so very dangerous. Some say, well, it is all religion that is dangerous in this sense. Nowadays, religion is sometimes considered not just a neurosis, but a psychosis, a dangerous thing.
Well, yes, this is right. I think it's important to remind the people who say this of two things. First of all, that you can't throw all religions into the same category. In my Tractatus, the first section of the Tractatus argues that there is no such thing as religion in a general sense. There are a great number of different religions, and each one has to be evaluated in terms of its truth value. That's one thing. Second thing that the secularist ought to be reminded of is that the atheisms of the 20th century managed to destroy more people than had ever been destroyed in any religious wars or all of them put together through the history of mankind. The Nazi persecutions, the Stalinist persecutions, these were infinitely worse than anything that has ever been blamed on religion in the course of human history. And, of course, the reason for this is obvious. If there isn't any God, then you can get away with anything. then might makes right. It's simply a question of power.
Dr. Montgomery, I was thinking about this when we were walking over some of the audio excerpts of the PBS special, The Question of God, and listening to Freud's thinking and the analysis of his thinking in his atheistic worldview. There have always been atheists, individual atheists. Scripture, as you quoted before, the fool in his heart says there is no God. But formal atheism, as a system of thought that is organized, that has the academy behind it in a certain sense, seems to be, and maybe I'm wrong, seems to be a far more recent occurrence. Am I reading history wrong here?
Well, I don't think even today there is any such thing as a comprehensive atheistic philosophy. The term is still applied to those who don't believe that there is any single meaningful transcendent explanation of the universe. And so you've got people like Dawkins who have turned evolution into a kind of general interpretive principle. You've got people like the Freudian psychoanalysts who use the materialistic understanding of the unconscious as a way of interpreting things. But you can't really develop a cosmic worldview that is simply negative, that simply says there isn't any God. More people will talk about being atheists, perhaps. But if you ask, well all right, fine, you're an atheist. What is your atheistic ethic, and how do you ground this? What is your atheistic political theory, and so forth? There aren't any answers in that respect at all.
We would be remiss if we did include one more excerpt from the PBS special, The Question of God. This one comes from an actor portraying G.K. Chesterton, a very influential figure in the life, of practically everybody, of course, but one of the figures featured in the PBS special, C.S. Lewis. Here's Chesterton's thought.
A great man knows he is not God, and the greater he is, the better he knows it. The Gospels declare that this mysterious maker of the world has visited his world in person. The most that any religious prophet has said was that he was the true servant of such a being. But the Creator was present in the daily life of the Roman Empire. That is something unlike anything else in nature. It is the one great startling statement that man has made since he spoke his first articulate word. It makes dust and nonsense of comparative religion.
Dr. Montgomery, your thoughts on that Chesterton excerpt?
Oh, I would go with that 1,000%. I have quoted Chesterton again and again in my Tractatus. Chesterton saw the essential difference between taking the revelation of God seriously and rationalizing one's way to the point where the only God of the universe is one's own self and one's own ideas. Chesterton was quite correct, and Chesterton had a great effect upon C.S. Lewis in that regard. There's no doubt about the fact that the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ is the starting point for clearing up this area. And I would say to the listeners to this program, if you have any doubts about the religious issues that we've been talking about here, the thing to do is to go to the New Testament and to check out the historicity of what's set forth there. In the days of Caesar Augustus, a decree went out that all the world should be taxed. This thing occurred in ordinary history, and there God became man, and then later he died for us to make it possible for us to return to God. And that can reconcile the broken personalities that we have. And that's the only answer. You're not going to get an answer to this by going to a psychoanalyst. You're only going to get an answer to this by going to the cross.
Dr. Montgomery, before we let you go, how many openings do you have for next summer's International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights in Strasbourg?
As of today, we have only 7 places left. And this is remarkable because the material for the program for July of 2005 just came off the press. And yet we are very, very close to being filled. So if there are people who want to do this, to go to the only Institute of Advanced Studies in Apologetics anywhere in the French Rhineland next summer, middle 2 weeks of July, my strong advice is to get in touch with us immediately. We are limited in the number of places that we have, and we do this intentionally because we want to have maximum contact with the students during those 2 weeks. And next summer we have Dr. A.E. Wilder Smith's son, Oliver Wilder Smith, a physician and a scientific apologist. We have Dr. Craig Hazen, the editor of the most widely read Christian Journal of Philosophy. We have Craig Parton, who appears on Issues Etc. constantly, and your humble servant. For 2 weeks, analyzing the most serious objections to Christian faith and providing the best answers.
Folks, we would be happy to send you a free brochure on this annual academy in Strasbourg, France. Call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. If you look under the What's New section, you'll find information on this academy. Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, thank you for being our guest.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Montgomery is Professor Emeritus at the University of Luton in England. He's a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, a member of the Bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's Distinguished Professor of Apologetics and the History of Christian Thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and author and editor of more than 50 books, including Tractatus Logico Theologicus. That book can be found and purchased on the web at CILTPP.com, www.CILTPP.com, or you can call 780-461-3076, 780-461-3076. Ask for the book Tractatus Logico Theologicus by Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. It is incomparable, not only to atheism, but to every other religion. What makes Christianity incomparable? Well, you can compare all you like as an academic exercise, but in terms of the truth claims, incomparable. The incarnation and everything that follows upon the incarnation. The God who creates all things enters into human history in a human body through the Virgin's womb and lives the life of a perfect human being, because that's exactly what he is incarnate to be, God and man. After this sinless life, he goes sinlessly to the cross, and he bears there the sins of all the world. I cannot think of anything comparable in any other religion or any other philosophy. And he rises again from the dead to show that who he said he was and what he said he would do are absolutely and positively true. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.